guardian.co.uk.
Welcome to the Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. A few weeks ago, we heard Colm Toybeane reading a story inspired by Conrad, which he wrote in the Art Angel Room for London. Here now is his visit to the Guardian Book Club to introduce his latest book, his imagining of a story never told in the Bible, The Testament of Mary, Mother of Jesus. He began his discussion with John Mullen by reading the opening.
If you imagine that it's in Ephesus, which is now Turkey, was Greece, it's about 20 years after the crucifixion, and that this is being spoken by Mary, the mother of Jesus. They appear more often now, both of them, and at every visit they seem more impatient with me and with the world. There's something hungry and rough in them, a brutality boiling in their blood, which I have seen before and can smell as an animal that is hunted can smell. But I'm not being hunted now, not anymore. I'm being cared for, questioned softly and watched. They think that I do not know the elaborate nature of their desires, but nothing escapes me now except sleep. Sleep escapes me. Maybe I'm too old to sleep, or there is nothing further to be gained from sleep. Maybe I do not need to dream or need to rest. Maybe my eyes know that soon they will be closed forever. I will stay awake if I have to. I will come down this passageway as the dawn breaks, as the dawn insinuates its rays of light into this room. I have my own reasons to watch and wait. Before the final rest comes this long awakening. And it is enough for me to know that it will end. They think I do not understand what is slowly growing in the world. They think I do not see the point of their questions and do not notice the cruel shadow of exasperation that comes hooded in their faces or hidden in their voices when I say something vague or foolish, something which leads us nowhere, when I seem not to remember what they think I must remember. They are too locked into their vast and insatiable needs and too dulled by the remnants of a terror we all felt then, to have noticed that I remember everything. Memory fills my body as much as blood and bones. I like it that they feed me and pay for my clothes and protect me, and in return I will do for them what I can, but no more than that. Just as I cannot breathe the breath of another or help the heart of someone else to beat or their bones not to weaken or their flesh not to shrivel, I cannot say more than I can say. And I know how deeply this disturbs them and how, and it would make me smile, this earnest need for foolish anecdotes or sharp, simple patterns in the story of what happened to us all. Except that I have forgotten how to smile. I have no further need for smiling, just as I had no further need for tears. There was a time when I thought, in fact, that I had no tears left, that I had used up my store of tears. But I'm lucky that foolish thoughts like this never linger or quickly replaced by what is true. There are always tears if you need them enough. It is the body that makes tears. I no longer need tears, and that should be a relief, but I do not seek relief. Merely solitude and some grim satisfaction which comes from the certainty that I will not say anything that is not true. Of the two men who came, one was there with us until the end. There were moments then when he was soft, ready to hold me and comfort me as he is ready now to scowl impatiently when the story I tell him does not stretch to whatever limits he has ordained. Yet I can see signs of that softness still, and there are times when the glow in his eyes returns before he sighs and goes back to his work, writing out the letters one by one that make words he knows I cannot read, but recount what happened on the hill and the days before and the days that followed. I've asked him to read the words aloud to me, but he will not. I know that he has written of things that neither he saw nor I saw. I know that he has also given shape to what I lived through and he witnessed, and that he has made sure that these words will matter, that he will be listened to. I remember too much. I'm like the air on a calm day as it holds itself still, letting nothing escape. As the world holds its breath, I keep memory in. So when I told him about the rabbits, I was not telling him something that I had half forgotten and merely remembered because of his insistent presence. The details of what I told him were with me all the years, in the same way as my hands or my arms were with me. On that day, the day he wanted details of, the day he wanted me to go over and over for him, in the middle of everything that was confused, in the middle of all the terror and shrieking and the crying out, a man came close to me who had a cage with a huge angry bird trapped in it. The bird all sharp beak and indignant gaze, the wings could not stretch to their full width, and this confinement seemed to make the bird frustrated and angry. It should have been flying, hunting, swooping on its prey. The man also carried a bag, which I gradually learned was almost half full of live rabbits, little bundles of fierce and terrorized energy. And during those hours on that hill, during the hours that went more slowly than any other hours, he plucked the rabbits one by one from the sack and edged them into the barely opened cage. The bird went for some part of their soft underbelly first, opening the rabbit up until its guts spilled out, and then, of course, its eyes. It is easy to talk about this now because it was a mild distraction from what was really going on. And it is easy to talk about it, too, because it made no sense. The bird did not seem to be hungry, although perhaps it suffered from a deep hunger that even the live flesh of writhing rabbits could not satisfy. The cage became half full of half-dead, wholly uneaten rabbits exuding strange squealing sounds, twitching with odd bursts of life. And the man's face was all bright with energy. There was a glow from him as he looked at the cage and then at the scene around him, almost smiling with dark delight, the sack not yet empty.
You said it's not a novella. I suppose what I meant...
A novella is something that no one reads.
No.
Isn't that what a novella is?
A novella is a book you can read all in one go, I suppose.
All right. Heart of Darkness.
Yeah.
Or... Okay. Turn of the Screw.
Turn of the Screw, getting towards short story, but yes.
Haji Murad.
Yeah. On Chesil Beach.
On Chesil Beach. The Death of Ivan Illich.
Yes.
Gotcha.
A book you can read all in one go. A book you might even feel sort of you should read all in one go, almost.
They're all novels, I think.
Okay.
Or right. Stories.
Okay, but...
I don't know.
But the compactness of this is part of the point of it, isn't it? That it has to be
Yeah, you can't have the, I suppose, amplitude of a novel because you lose everything, I think, in that. If you try and extend it to further events and
yes.
Side plots and other characters having meaning, you sort of lose what you're looking for, which is a sort of quality of intensity. So it can't be longer.
And that's there in Mary's narrative as well, isn't it? In her consciousness of her story, in that she's narrating with a sense of getting it out while she can.
Yeah, there has to be a sense, I think, of her having no time. Time, rather than the pages of a book, the time for someone to speak. And obviously that time has to be limited.
These two men yep. who were never named, who are writing down her story...
Yeah, I probably misnamed it too, in the sense that one is clearly John. And because John writes later, and he's the dramatist, he's the good writer, the good storyteller among the four. And also that he had been in Greece. And so I imagined him among the crowd, among the huge crowd at the theatre, watching somebody being Medea or Electra or Antigone, and bringing that to bear on the story he told. So he's there. And also, he's soft. I mean, that she likes him. But the other one, and this is an anachronism, it isn't possible, really, but the other one is Paul. And he's mean. And he doesn't even want a woman in the room with him. And he sees everything. Paul sees the future in a way that John doesn't quite. And this woman is not to be in the future. And both of these men were in Ephesus. Paul was, in fact, imprisoned in Ephesus because he wanted the silversmiths to stop making these small effigies, these small examples of Artemis, and they put them in prison. So both of them were in Ephesus. The Ephesus thing is strange because really the only evidence we have that Mary might have died in Ephesus is a John saying at the that Jesus said on the cross to John, "This is thy mother," and the other way around, "This is thy son." So maybe John took Mary with him where he went. And then a nun in Germany had a dream, which I suppose nuns in Germany are entitled to. And she dreamt that if they dug down deep in Ephesus, they would find Mary's house. But the thing is, when I looked carefully at Ephesus, or even looked casually at it, if you dig down deep in Ephesus, you find everything. You know, in other words, it's all archaeology. You know, it's barely a landscape at all. It's a sort of archaeology. And so they dug down and they found a house. And they said, "This is Mary's house." And I think as a way of annoying the Turks, John Paul II went there and he said it was Mary's house. And I suppose Benedict, who does, I think, like to annoy the Turks more than John Paul II, he went there too to do the same. So people are now going there because it's the house of Mary. But there really isn't any evidence for that.
These men, John and Paul, if it be them, who are writing stuff down, they are sort of interrogating her. They want her account, don't they? Even if they're going to change it.
Yes, and I suppose they're also worried if anyone else should get their hands on her, what that would be like. But also, she's traumatized. This experience of 20 years earlier is unresolved experience, so that she is living in it all the time. She's unsure where she is. And these two men want the soft stories about the childhood of Jesus and the time he got lost and he was found. And of course, lurking in the background, which is the whole issue of you know, the virgin birth and all of that stuff, which, of course, I don't want to go into because it's really very difficult. She's very concrete in how she remembers. So those large questions don't interest her.
Of course, the other person who's never named in the story is Mary's son, whom she talks about. She never names him.
Yeah, the source for that is... I wrote a short book on Lady Gregory, and her son was shot down over Italy in 1918. And so she lives for 14 more years. And she, you know, her diaries are published. And also I went through her correspondence in the New York Public Library. And she never names Robert Gregory again. She never says Robert. She never says, "Oh, Robert," when Robert says, "The grave," or "My darling," or "The grave in Italy," or "him." Like she can't bring herself to say his name, which of course makes its way into Yeats's poem, In Memory of Major Robert Gregory, where his name in the title, but he's not named in the poem. And in the end, it says that it took my heart for speech, you know, that he can't be named. And so I just had that from, I began to trace it in Lady Gregory's, in those 14 years of Lady Gregory. Was there any moment where she names Robert again? And it was so fascinating, the number of terms she used. He was her only child, and that she didn't. Or at least she may have once or twice, but in general she didn't. And she found all sorts of names, so it was just on my mind. Mm.
The relationship between Mary and her son, as narrated by her, is lack of sympathy, of obduracy. You use, for instance, that odd and famous line in which I think is in the Marriage at Cana episode, where he says, "Woman, what have I to do with you?" Despite this visceral maternal feeling that runs through the book. That seems like a vignette of what their relationship is.
I suppose there is just something else about not saying his name, that it just is difficult to say the name. It's difficult to put the name into a novel, into fiction. What I was trying to establish was the visceral thing, the business of blood, the business of this being in the bones, but that at another level, this only caused her distress. So the two things going, the ordinary business of the day causing her distress, and yet all she wanted was him back, him safe, him well. So those two things against each other. Mm.
And she is the only kind of real semblance of religious instinct that you get from her is is kind of pagan, isn't it? She goes to the Temple of Artemis in...
Yeah, I mean, I was interested in, you know, William James's idea that there is a sort of space in people and that it can be filled easily by religion, or that there's a sort of... people acquire that, can acquire faith very easily in places. And so, yes, there isn't just that, I think. There's also the sense of the sky and the wind and the world itself as interesting her more than as a material thing, as some other presence for her. Even death itself coming as a sort of almost a spiritual thing. And yes, the one she sees, but there's also the mention of the Sabbath. You know, being a mother on the Sabbath and the day where you look inwards and there's silence, and therefore the day that for her was special, because when they came home, there was a sense of all three of them as having a sort of peace that was never there otherwise, that she remembered very specially. So there was that religion, but also, yes, that once under such pressure, I mean the pressure of having been through the crucifixion, once she goes anywhere and sees anything, it is almost that will come to her as icon, as spiritual object, as something that she can hold on to. And in the case of that landscape, in all the archaeological museums all along that coast, these extraordinary huge statues, which for her would have been so extraordinary because she would never have seen anything like them before, with this figure that is Artemis, that almost becomes Diana, that can represent everything from fertility to abidance to, you know, everything. And the shadows of the temple, which is the temple of Diana, of course, which is very close to the house they've designated as Mary's house, the ruins of the temple of Diana.
At the heart of this book, if you were reading it as a believer, as a Christian, is her accounts of the miracles. And there are one or two miracles which she narrates by report. She hasn't actually seen them.
But and the people she hears it from
haven't
seen it either. But it is as though in this time, when the Romans are moving in and new coins are coming and new ways of having work, you know, that suddenly in this vacuum or in this space created, people are ready to believe. And people are ready to believe even that the dead will come back.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the part that surprised me most, because I didn't think, there's a wonderful poem by Tom Gunn.
Yeah.
Where the last line of every verse is, the appointed miracle did not take place.
Yeah.
It's called Lazarus unraised, and then the appointed miracle did not take place. And that was on my mind, that what was I going to do with Lazarus? Because even the word Lazarus, Lady Lazarus, Sylvia Plath, like it's, but I found, I suppose it was that Rilke poem, the idea of someone's death being a sort of fullness or a sort of thing that you must not interfere with. And that therefore the miracle, were it to take place, was an interference with something absolutely fundamental to us all. So I just went where it took me. And therefore I decided that in the end, when I was revising it, to leave it so ambiguous that it was almost part of the time that anything could happen, or that people could believe anything could happen, and that she doesn't know what to do about this, but her friends do. I mean, Miriam in the book does, Mary Magdalene, they know. They saw it. They were there for it. So she has to figure this, which is almost like having to be around people who have deep religious faith, and you don't, where you have to sometimes just let them loose on you, you know, let them free. Let them feel what they feel without... I mean, Virginia Woolf used to ask T.S. Eliot what he said when he prayed, so as even Vanessa could howl with laughter afterwards. Eliot was very clever enough never to tell them, but they were desperate to know because they thought it would be really interesting. You know, what do you say when you pray?
In the novel, there's two groups of people who are sure that they know what's going to happen. There are those who have decided that Mary's son has got to die.
Yeah.
And There are those who are sure that this story is going to take over the world.
Yeah.
That the arrangement of all those famous events, Pilate's intervention, the crowd, Barabbas, it's all kind of fixed.
From her version of it, she sees cruelty and she sees people wanting blood. And that really surprises her because it's something she's not ever felt. And it's something she doesn't ever forget, that in those days she saw people who wanted blood. And it gives her a version of the human presence on the world, but especially of men, that really never leaves her. So it was just a dramatic thing that I could work with, that she gave her enough that she fears these two men in the house, and she doesn't want them around and the stench of them near her. And therefore it gives her, there's a sort of, it gives attention to the text where she actually is afraid, and she's good reason to be afraid.
It's as if you make her foresee all these succoring images that especially painters later provided with. Yeah. She sort of, it's not just that she has her own version, she seems to, you make her foresee that her version will be displayed, will give way.
She has a sense of their vast ambition. And the issue is an interesting one, that in the early years of Christianity, she was to be merely the mortal mother of Jesus. But it was in Ephesus itself, rather than Rome, in 431, at a council, that she was declared to be the mother of God.
Well, we're in a very, very genial frame. So, have we got a microphone to pass around, have we?
I've read quite a few of your earlier books. It's quite striking how, even in books which are predominantly set in Ireland, for instance, religion is not a major theme. So it's very interesting that you're taking what seems like a new departure in that direction, but also even doing historical fiction, if it can be called that as well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. It's very, very difficult to write about a Catholic unless you write fully about the Catholic, unless Catholicism becomes the subject. So that for example, Brian Moore's Black Robe, where the Jesuit in the 16th century realizes that if he intervenes, he will be killed. But of course, being killed will be meaning he will go into eternal life. This means his fear, his motives, everything about him are all in a way reduced to some extent because of his belief. And Moore was very interested also in unbelief, as was Graham Greene, and both of them, I mean, admired each other. And but I realized with the earlier novels that although the characters were living in a Catholic milieu, and although they were ostensibly Catholics, if I did that of giving them the full business of, you know, I'm on the edge of a cliff. Were I to fall off the cliff, I would fall into eternal life. So I mustn't be too careful. Would actually just worry my novel and reduce the actual business of, I want the person on the cliff just to take careful steps on that cliff. You know, so that it's a very difficult thing to do in a novel without putting it in every page, every motive, every moment, and to try and... Therefore, some things become so predetermined by either faith or loss of faith or moments of loss of faith that the novel becomes what I suppose was called, and again, Conor Cruz O'Brien wrote the book called Mariah Cross, the Catholic novel, which Francois Mauriac wrote, which George Bernanos wrote, and Graham Greene. I think that's one of the reasons why Joyce, very cleverly, I mean, there are many other reasons, but one of the reasons, after Portrait of the Artist and Dubliners, realizing that he would be very, very careful in a novel and making Leopold Bloom a secular Jew, just got him out of the whole problems of having Leopold Bloom, you know, having to think about eternal life in a full Catholic way. So yes, it's a really difficult one. I mean, I think the novel is effectively a secular form. And always has been. And you can bring religion into it, but at great cost, I think.
In the context of patriarchal religion, was there for you anything consciously radical or even feminist about giving a really strong voice and words to Mary and making her, as you say, the goddess instead of just a vessel for a god?
I'm really not sure that Mary, even within Catholicism, is such a muted or such a reduced figure, because I think people did, because of her very silence, people filled that silence with their own needs or with their own imaginings, especially in countries, say, in Poland and in Ireland, when there were other needs, that Mary became not only Queen of Heaven, but Queen of Poland, that somehow or other, that people were, you know, adding to her or giving her an enormous power, because her silence lent itself to that. And also the choir would sing Ave Verum, you know, as a natural thing to sing. I mean, there were other terrible ones, you know, some of the I'll sing a hymn to Mary were awful. I mean, some of the Irish Catholic hymns were an absolute disgrace to our race. But you wouldn't want to be associated with them. You know, there's one called Sweetheart of Jesus, we implore, oh, make us love thee more and more. But she's mentioned in Sylvia Plath that there is something about the word Mary, Mother, the robes, the holiness. And then, of course, there's Titian's, you know, Mary. There's the Renaissance Mary. So, yeah, I mean, there it all is. But it's hard to call it devotion. I mean, there was devotion to Mary, and there is still devotion to Mary. I mean, she appeared in Ireland, you know, in 1879, which is an interesting year. My friend Roddy Doyle wrote about this in 1979, when the Pope was about to come to Ireland, and he was to celebrate her having come in 1879. But he realised that Patrick Pearse, who led the 1916 rebellion, was also born in 1879. But Roddy looked at the dates and realised that she obviously came to Knock in the west of Ireland. With the way the roads were at the time, it would have taken her a while to get to Dublin to give birth to Patrick Pearse. and we were all really jealous, because an Irish language newspaper, it was the time of the Ayatollah, said that young man, Roddy Doyle, should have his hands cut off. What's interesting is that she didn't speak in Ireland, because, of course, what language could she speak in? You see, she couldn't have an English accent, because then we wouldn't want her. Okay. And then she couldn't have an Irish accent, because clearly the Queen of Heaven wasn't Irish. She couldn't speak Gaelic, because, you know, so she just said nothing. But I believe when she went to Medjugorje in Herzegovina, she spoke pure, with a pure, lovely Croatian accent.
I'm such a huge fan. I travelled to Dublin last year to see The Testament, the play. So I'm just quite curious to understand the link between the play and the book, and which came first. And
Could you tell everybody about the play?
I mean, what happened was,
some people don't know.
What happened was that at last year's Dublin Theatre Festival, directed by Gary Hines, Marie Mullen played the part in the Project Arts Centre as part of the theatre festival. What we did was we took this text and reduced it. But the cutting was extremely interesting. We spent 5 weeks doing it, the three of us. In a novel, a novel is a journey. You know, so many novels have just someone setting out from one place, going to another, and all the things that happen to them on the way. And you can put a lot of that into a novel. So if you have A and B in a novel, oh, great. You can have, you know, stopping off in a hotel on the way. But in a play, you cannot have that. A play will not hold it. So what kept falling away would be both the actress and the director saying to me, you know, when she leaves home and needs to go to Jerusalem, that whole section, oh, but that's got, yeah, we know, but look, Marie, do it. And Marie would act it for me, and I'd say, you're absolutely right. We don't need it. And I would then go, cut. That, in other words, if you want to arrive, if you want B, you simply change the light and you get B. But the journey to B is of no interest to the audience. So the cutting was amazing. And what was also interesting was watching Marie Mullen, who has played so many of the great parts in Irish theatre, building up a slow trust with the audience so that anyone who came along thinking that we were involved in, you know, efforts to shock people or to try and cause horror or to get involved in controversy, Marie led them away from that with her voice and her movements, so that no matter who came to the theatre, no one ever walked out or ever interrupted, no matter who came.
Are we going to liberate Colm for his guardian
vintage? Why have you brought this?
The Holy Bible?
Yeah.
Well, because I was just looking at some of the detail, you know, just wanted to check.
I thought you were going to give us a reading from it.
No.
What passage you had
chosen?
Well,
because you're actually reading your book. You know, I read most of the Gospel according to St. John to see, you know, just in a kind of dry old way to see which bits you were in, and they're in different order and, you know, all that sort of, the kind of thing academics do sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, my goodness, this is sort of a vignette, really, isn't it? Or this is an epitome of what...
He's good, John.
Because
he's got me to read the
whole of the Gospel of St. John, beginning to end. It's not very long, actually. When did I last do that? Maybe never. There you are. So those jolly bishops and nuncios and things who greeted you, maybe they knew that this novel would do the work of sending people back to the good book.
Oh, that'd be great, wouldn't it?
Well, maybe this is the time then to say thank you very much to him for his.
Thank you very much.
Wonderful.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.